Hello and you're very welcome to the Thistle and Shamrock. I'm Fiona Ritchie and I'm very pleased this week to be joined by a true ambassador of song, Jean Redpath. She has an encyclopedic knowledge of folk song, is a foremost interpreter of the songs of Robert Burns, and many of you will know her through her decades of appearances with Garrison Keillor on A Prairie Home Companion. Enjoy a visit with Jean Redpath.
South wind of a gentle rain, you banish winter weather, bring summer to the pool again, the bees among the heather. If north wind blow, you mean to blow, as you rustle soft above me, God speak.
Jean, it's been many years since we've met up.
Far too long, actually.
But the memories come flooding back of when we first met in the States, when you were touring over there and singing, as you do, still travelling around, and you came to North Carolina. I want to go back before then, though, and talk about your earliest days, before you and I ever did meet, when you first fell in love with the songs that have become your life story.
Well, kind of interesting we should be doing this now, Fiona, because it's full circle. The School of Scottish Studies has an anniversary about now, and I started out there with Hamish Henderson, who was friend and mentor for many years, who came to the Literary Society when I was a student and did a talk on traditional song and played a tape of Jeannie Robertson singing The Overgate, and there was epiphany for me, because I had a song very like it in a different tune from my mother, and bubbled up to him saying, oh, I know, and I teased him for years and never forgave him, his response was, "My, that's an interesting variant. You know, I had just made this world-shaking, life-changing discovery, and what did he call it? An interesting variant." Anyway, it didn't put me off my stride, and that was the beginning of it. And since then, I have become a slightly more organized, not terribly, and a good deal further traveled and done full circle back to artist in residence at the School of Scottish Studies. So some people managed to graduate in 4 years. It's taken me 50.
Was on the summer's evening, away afore the sun gaed doon. A lassie wi' a braw new goon come out the hills to ye go in. The rose bud washed in summer, sure's been fresh within the sunny bour. But Kitty was the fairest flower that e'er was seen in Gowrie. Her cousin, she come there, but oh, the scene was passing fair. What in Scotland can compare with the castle Gowrie? The sun was setting on the day, the blue hills melting into grey, the mavis and the blackbirds lay were sweetly heard in Gowrie. Oh, land, the lassie I had wooed and truth and constancy had vowed, but could nae speed wi' her I lured until she saw me Gowrie. I pinted tae my feathers haw, yon bonny field I on the shaw, sae loon that there nae blast could blaw, would she no bide in Gowrie? Her feather was baith glad, and why her mother she would nothing say. The bairnies thought they would get play if Kitty gae to Gowrie. She whiles did smile, she whiles did greet, the blush and tear were on her cheek. She nothing said and hung her head, but knew she's Lady Gowrie.
I suppose one of the first main journeys you made in your early singing career was to take yourself over to the States in the early 60s.
That's right. And I can, again, thank friends and mentors and role models at Edinburgh for that. The late Angus McIntosh, who was my English professor, was the friend I turned to when I realised I was really struggling with undergraduate studies and what was the point of this anyway, and 4 years at university for what. And eventually, bless his heart, he agreed that maybe it would be wise for me to do something else, at least for a little while, because I was going down gurgling. And we kicked around the alternatives, including being an au pair in France. And he never said, "Oh my heavens, what are you thinking?" He smiled and said, "And then what?" Or going and doing outdoor work at Aviemore, which was just coming into its own as an outdoor centre. And again, he smiled and said, "Sounds interesting. And then what?" And I said, "Well, I also have an invitation to go to California, sing at a friend's wedding, and I would have a place to stay at least." And so when I left that session, he said, I think maybe what you need to do is go home and apply for a passport." So that was all I needed by way of a gentle push in that direction, never having the slightest intention of becoming a professional entertainer or even singing for a living. That was not on the cards when I took off. I did casual labour. I did dollar-an-hour work for 6 months before I ever moved from that farm, which was great.
And had you done much public performing in Scotland when you were in Edinburgh or when you were at your own sort of family home before that? Or had it been really social singing?
I think at that stage there wasn't much of a distinction between the two. You know, as a student, we did a lot of singing, and yes, some of it was even paid for. Mostly in beer, I think. I don't remember ever having a fee attached to a performance. But social singing, we sang for fun, which I guess is social singing. And hopefully, one of the things I have managed to hang on to is that although economically I've had to be aware of where I was going, what they were going to pay me, and whether or not it was financially viable, it has always been social singing for me. If it isn't fun, why am I doing it?
When first the tune come for to stop a wheel, I started up in business in my side street shop. To the kirk every Sunday I get twice as a rule, and counted the collection for the Sunday school. For my greatest ambition it was, you see, to tell a wee bit story at the kirk soiree. Now my chance came at last, but Lord preserve us, I couldn't say a word, for I felt that nervous. I thought upon a limerick and I thought upon a riddle. I started on a story, but I stopped it in the middle. For the story I had started, it was not, you see, the kind you can tell at a kirk soiree. After that evening, men would stop for the finish of my story in my side street shop. My business grew so rapidly, and so did my renown, that soon I was elected for the council of the town. And they made me the convener of the sewerage committee for the story I had started at the kirk soiree. When I became a magistrate, promotion proved my ruin, for the first time that I sat upon the bench was my undoing. For objectionable conduct I did try a friend of mine, and gave him 7 days without the option of a fine, for telling to a bobby, a staunch wee free, the story I had started at the kirk soiree. So I retired from public life a disappointed man, with my mouth all twisted telling stories in a hand my hand. Now many years have passed since fortune gave me such a knock, but just the other evening I received an awful shock. For the minister's flapper doctor at her feathers jubilee told the story I had started at the kirk soiree.
At Nellotafty there lived a man in the neighbourhood of Fyvie. He had a bonny daughter dear, whose name was Bonnie Annie. Lord Fyvie had a trumpeter by the name of Andrew Lammie. He had Fyvie, he raised by the mill, for livid Tafty's Annie, and this trumpeter raid him before even the same Andrew Lammie. Her mother cried her to the door, saying, come here to me, my Annie. Did see a bonnier man than the trumpeter of Fyvie? Naething she said but sigh and sore, alas for Bonnie Annie. She durst na own her heart was won by the trumpeter of Fyvie. At night when all get to their bed, all sleep it soon, but Annie, love so oppressed, her tender breast, thinking on Annie. It's love comes in at my bedside, and love lies down beside me. Love so oppresses my tender breast, and love will waste my body.
first I meet and my love met, 'twas in the words of Ivy. He called me mistress, I said no, I was Defty's bonnie Annie. It's up and doon in Defty's den, where the burn runs clear and bonny. I've often gane to meet my love, my bonnie and lovey. Her feather come to hear this, and I'll let her rope to Fivey to say his daughter was bewitched by his servant. Lord Fivey, read by the bell, what ails ye, bonny Annie? It's all for love that I'm in deed, for bonny young Annie. Oh, Tefty, Tefty, give consent, and let your daughter marry. Be to no a higher degree than the trumpeter Fivey. Had she been born of a richer kin, as she is rich in beauty, we'll award it in the last myself and me. Fivey's lands are far and wide, and they are wondrous bonny, but I would na gie my ain true love, no for a' your lands of Fivey. At this our feather struck her soul, and likewise dead her mother. Her sisters, oh, they did her scorn, but weighs me for her brother. Her brother struck her wondrous sore with cruel strokes and many. He broke her back on the high hard oar of her life. Feather mother, sisters all, why so cruel to your Annie? My heart was broken first by love, knew my brother's broken my body. Oh, mother, mother, mark my bed and lay my face to Fivey. Thus will I lie, and thus I'll die, for my ain dear and lammie.
When you went to California to sing at the wedding, did you come back to Edinburgh, or was it after that that you made your way to New York City?
It was 20 months before I was back in Scotland, and by that time I was already on the boards. I was moving. I had moved to New York City. I think it was March through September I stayed in San Francisco, which still has a large part of my heart. That's a lovely place. But I thought to myself, how long am I here for? When I got a letter from a man I never met, and I suspect he's no longer with us, but he cheerfully wrote and said, I've booked you into a club in Philadelphia at $175 a week. Now, that was a small fortune in 1961, because I was, as I say, doing a dollar an hour, driving cars, cleaning houses, looking after kids. I begged, borrowed and stole. I can't remember where I found the money. I must have earned it, I suppose, to fly to Philly, and discovered that there really was no such job, or at least if there was, I was going to be auditioning for 3 weeks and not getting paid for it. So I cheerfully thought, well, I'll go to New York, and I think about that now and break out in a cold sweat, Fiona. I don't think I'd do the same thing. Well, many things I wouldn't do at this age that I did then. One is immortal at that age, but I also had been told Ken Goldstein wants to do a recording, and indeed, when I spoke with Ken on the phone, he said, yeah, we'd like to record, but I don't know where that man got his dates, but come up and we'll talk about it. Happily, he wasn't far from Philly and rode into New York on the top of Bob Beer's Psaltery in the back of his Volkswagen. And when they said, where can we drop you? I said, well, the YWCA, and they turned pale and said, you'll never be heard from again. We must know somebody you can stay with, and thereby started my second career as a professional house guest.
You can look back at periods of your life now and think, gosh, lots of things were coming together at that particular place and time. But when you're moving through it, you're not aware of these things. I was watching a programme, a really wonderful programme, about the club in Los Angeles called The Troubadour. Uh-huh. And all the artists who coalesced around there sort of in the 70s, James Taylor and Carole King and Joni Mitchell and Jackson Brown and all these. And they also interviewed the comedian Steve Martin, who's a great, you know, banjo bluegrass player, and at that time was more into the music scene than into the comedy. And he said, well, it's sort of like Monet arrived painting the way he was painting, and then suddenly at that time and in that place, a whole lot of people were painting like Monet, and you had Impressionism. And he felt as if it was sort of like that with the singer-songwriter thing that was happening mm-hmm. around the Troubadour. I'm wondering if we can stretch that to what was happening in New York around Greenwich Village at that time, where really important characters in folk music were all meeting up and coming together. They were all a similar age. And I'm wondering if you look back at it and think that there was something magical in what was coming together and what was kind of brewing at that time, and that you were part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think folk music was the pop music, if you will, of that particular era. I don't quite know why traditional music and or singer-songwriter music would be quite as powerful at that point, but I don't think it's going to happen again. There is another revival about every 12 or 14 years. I think that's largely because a whole new generation, in quotes, discovers traditional music again. But that was the only time I think it's likely that instead of being the high water mark, it's almost a lunatic fringe. It's an underground movement. It's something that has never really been totally mainstream, except perhaps in the 60s. And I suspect that maybe it's to its advantage that that was true. Otherwise, it will have been watered down, commercialized, or otherwise changed beyond recognition. But I was lucky enough to fall, and literally fall, step right into the middle of the folk song revival. And the phone call that Bob made to Mickey Isaacson, whose apartment I stayed in on and off for several years after that, was serendipitous, because Mickey, who loved traditional music, did not sing herself, thought what she could do was provide crash space for all of the itinerant musicians around, I being one of the fortunate beneficiaries, and Bobby Dylan being another. And he landed in New York City, of course, at exactly the same time. So I, through no fault of or credit to myself, landed smack in the middle of the action, as it were, in Greenwich Village. And it was a very exciting time, and one needed to be 23 to survive it, I think.
I think it was in 2004 Bob Dylan accepted the honour of an honorary doctorate from St Andrews University, having turned down many similar offers. I think he'd only previously accepted one from Yale, I believe, but he's not a man of many words and didn't speak much about his decision at the time. But I couldn't help but wonder if it wasn't his way of connecting with what clearly was an influence in his music, that of Scottish folk song, the melody, the shape. Mm-hmm. And I stretched as well to think perhaps that he must have learned some of these from you, because you being together around at the same time in Greenwich Village, he eventually went on to sing, I think, Pretty Peggy or write a song based around it. And I felt myself at the time that you must have been part of that history for him.
I have no idea, because I don't think at that point it ever occurred to me to think in terms of migration of song across the Atlantic or from person to person. I was just having too much fun singing the stuff that I already knew. Wasn't, I don't think, consciously even learning a lot of new stuff, and thrilled to be in the middle of so much music, most of which I would never have heard had I stayed at home. And of course, Dylan would be one of them. I do remember one evening, Bob and I were on the same bill at Gertie's Folk City, and he had done his set, and I got up and sang whatever it was I was singing at the time, including the Patriot game. And when I came off, somebody said to me, "Well, that was pretty gutsy." I said, "What?" He said, "Were you making the point that Bob's song was a traditional tune that had another set of words?" I said, "No, it was totally unconscious. Obviously, I'd heard him sing, and it pushed a button in this global search that goes on in the head. That's the song that it spat up, but I surely was not saying, na 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 na, nah, we got there first."
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there, the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side.
With God on Our Side, Bob Dylan. The song's melody is One Morning in May, or God on Our Side, and Dylan's song was probably inspired by Dominic Behan's song Patriot Game, one of many hundreds in the repertoire of Jean Redpath. She's my guest this week. She's celebrating 50 years of sharing songs with international audiences through her performances, her recordings and her radio work. We're going to be hearing about her many appearances on A Prairie Home Companion. So stay with us for more conversation from Jean's Scottish home in the East Newcastle Fife, and more of her songs from across the decades. Look for a full playlist online in the coming days, and listen again if you miss something here on your radio. That's all online at thistleradio.com. This is NPR.
Done something quite fun, which is that you've put together a collage poster, which you kindly sent a copy of to me, and I thought it'd be very fun to take it out. And although it's radio, get ask people to bear with us. And have you just kind of reminisce a little bit as we look around it? It says here, Jean Redpath sings 50 years, and we have a lovely montage of mostly album covers, some album inserts. What do you think of when your eye scans around this this collage?
Well, I look at some of these photographs and think, who was that, you know, or who is that? It's interesting because one of the things that occurs to me, not only have I tried to leave a whole mess of songs readily available to anybody that's interested so that they can learn them and sing them, that's the whole point of this. I see myself very much as a resource, if you will, and although I thoroughly enjoy making people laugh and cry from a stage, ideally what these CDs are all about are as a vehicle for continuing the tradition. The early ones were done in a oneer. I'm not even sure that the jacket of the early one is there, because these were either, they're actually all either LPs or CDs, Fiona. And the ones that are hidden just indicate that there's a whole mess of these as LPs, and these have been reproduced as CDs. But the very early ones were done in a oneer. The one I did with Ken that I mentioned a little earlier, for instance, this one here, Skip and Barfoot, I think was a straight recording session of 7 hours. At that age, of course, stamina was not a problem, and adrenaline was wonderful stuff, and I knew beforehand from Ken what he wanted me to sing, and we just went straight through them. And the others, I've got a little more sophisticated at times, of course, the Burns ones being at the opposite end of that scale, because that was 20 years of work with Serge on the Burns songs, and these are quite heavily orchestrated. He was a composer, so he was interested in the instrumentation, and there are many, many tracks of instruments on these. I guess it's a matter of some surprise to me that I've actually lived this long and produced this much, because it was only done one day at a time like everybody else. Some of the photographs, of course, are actually much more an indication of where the photographer's mind was at the time than me. I mean, it's appropriate to the title, Laddie Lie Near Me, but I don't know that I have ever posed quite like that for anybody under any condition, but there you go.
Now you look, and you know, you're giving the impression, this is radio, of course, that we're looking at something dodgy, but in fact it's very tasteful. You look like you're, I think you look like you're peeking out from behind a net curtain.
I am actually, it's a net curtain.
Curtain twitching.
It is a curtain, yes.
And it is interesting to look at the various Serge Hovey album covers, because that was an amazing project that took really quite a considerable amount of your time. Working through the collection of Burns songs as orchestrated by Serge Hovey, mm-hmm. set to the original Burns melodies, which many people had strayed away from and not realised, you know,
right.
what Burns had done.
That's right. Well, this is what attracted me originally, was the fact that I, to my shame, like many Scots, I think, knew precious little about Robert Burns songs. You know, we got a certain amount of, I would say, the top ten, almost by default at school, because I'm fond of pointing out that my musical education in high school was almost entirely about English art song. I think the situation hopefully has changed somewhat. But when Serge had finished, or at least completed to his satisfaction, the Robert Burns songbook on paper, but decided that was really only half of the project, these things should be recorded, did Hamish know of a singer? He said, yes, there's one in the States already, why don't you contact Jane? And of course that was the beginning of I think 20 years it took us to do these seven recordings, because Serge never ever compromised on anything at any time. Bless his heart, 18 years with ALS, and at the end he was still working with a letter board, and when he was critiquing something I was singing and started to spell it out for his wife, he started every sentence with the. Never mind going straight for a noun and a verb, as most people would do to shorthand, not Serge. He sounded out the whole sentence.
He was in a special wheelchair, left by the end, only with the use of facial muscles, presumably, living as a quadriplegic, really.
Well, by then he was bedbound. He'd been on a breathing machine for many, many years, and the only movement he had at this point was to move his lower jaw for a yes, so that if you've ever seen anybody work with a letter board, the alphabet is broken up into specific groupings of letters, the first line being of vowels. So does the word start with a vowel? Is it an A? Is it, you know, one at a time? And when he clicked his jaw, that meant yes. So it was a long and quite painful, and I'm sure for him, tiring process, which is why it's staggering that he would bother with the insignificant words. But that was Serge, and our first recording was very much a trial by fire, because we did not obviously see things from the same perspective. As far as I'm concerned, a song needs a voice and a set of words. You have a tune and a set of words and a voice to produce them. Where Serge was coming from, I think one of his recordings had three piano tracks, one of which was a closed loop, two string quartets, three French horns, and a partridge. I mean, the whole orchestra in there, and frequently a chorus as well. And the only thing I ever locked horns with him on, I said, no, I will not coach the chorus on how to sing that line in Scots. I will not do it. People can't do that. They are either going to have to make the best shot they can or hum. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Scottish language tutor. Also, I cannot sing that song the way you've got it arranged, because you're having me count off nine bars before I deliver the punchline. And that's not only impossible for me because I can't count that well, it's very bad theatre. So once we got things like that straightened up, we were fine. That's amazing, man. Amazing, man.
Yeah. That clock's very good theatre. That was
it
right
is,
on
yes,
the...
It is, dying.
That was the only instrument he hadn't used.
That's right.
Caught to gie her a sleigh. Blessed be the hour she cooled in her linens, and blithe be the bird that sings on her grave. Come to my hymns, my Katie, my Katie, and come to my hymns and kiss me again. Drachen or sober, here's to thee, Katie, and blessed be the day that I did it again.
Really, a big part of your story in the United States has been your relationship with radio and radio programmes.
That's true.
Robert J. Lertzma, of course, Morning Pro Musica, and then I think people who didn't have an awareness of traditional music and folk song would have encountered you via Garrison Keillor and A Prairie Home Companion, and you were often brought on as a musical performer and as a sort of a comedy sidekick.
That's true. Curious that in the last few years, I think because he's now become a great deal more, what will I call it? Maybe organised is the word I'm looking for. I know in the early days there was a lot of seat of the pants flying on these shows, but I think he now has a regular staff so that he knows beforehand who is going to be doing what, and takes a lot of the pressure off of him, especially when they take that show on the road as often as they do. I mean, that I don't know where he finds his energy and his stamina, but he's pretty high powered on both fronts. People say, how did you meet him? I honestly don't remember. I mean, there's so many things that just kind of happened. I think Garrison and Margaret were catching any wandering minstrels or passing musicians for both the radio show and concert series. This is back in the late 70s at this point, because the first time I went, I know we did the radio show and then went straight on and did a concert afterwards. And Garrison was also doing a radio show, I think, seven mornings a week.
That's right.
Just an incredible schedule. So that was quite different and much more relaxed. And I was back many times on my own and with quite a few people that I sang with and hung out with on the East Coast as well. So it's been great fun.
And it gave you the opportunity to, you know, having sung murder ballads and about lost love and broken hearts, to sort of sing about tuna fish and
yes,
things like that.
Goof off instead.
Soft as the voice of my mother, calling as night shadows fell, calling her children to song.
Oh. Jane.
There's a good slice of native-born ham in my makeup, as well as the Celtic melancholia, but I found in the process of developing some kind of performing style, it makes it so much easier for an audience to give credence to a classic ballad or to listen to something which expresses the inexpressible if, in the interim, you can also make them laugh. It's all right to make an audience cry, but also give them a chance to laugh. And I guess I'm, as I say, I'm a ham.
I've made mistakes in the past, things that I blush over yet, but I hardly ever regret being quiet. I have a TV at home, and I do really enjoy it. I can just leave it alone, and it's quiet. If there's occasion to holler, I'll buy it. I can make noise with the best. Most of the rest of the time, I'm quiet. I'm not unsociable, no. People are fine in repose, but somehow my favorites are those who are quiet. Quiet's a wonderful sound, sweeter than oboe or fiddle. Someday I'm gonna be found in the middle of quiet. If there's occasion to holler, I'll buy it. I can make noise with the best, but most of the rest of the time, I'm quiet. Sing me a song of the sea, soft as the breath of a breeze. Sing me to sleep and then please keep quiet.
This question of what place does traditional music have either on a platform, literally, physically, you know, on a platform with a microphone, or on the radio, it's supposed to be done at the fireside, is something that I've stopped even thinking about. We're in an age of mass communication, and it should be something that should be embraced, I think, wholeheartedly. You won't get the response, but by the same token, you have no idea at all how you are affecting any given person at any given time, because I am always knocked sideways when I get somebody coming up or sending a note saying, where can I find that song? It reduced me to tears because I haven't heard it since my mother sang it and she died recently. Or, you know, you have no idea at all whose life you are touching. And this presumably is easier to do on the level of loss than it is on the level of comedy, because comedy, unless it's taking part in one of Garrison's skits or one of these outrageous parodies he writes on traditional melodies, comedy depends so very much on your frame of reference and the context you're working within. And it's one of the reasons that I don't sing a lot of Scottish comic songs, because it takes 2 minutes to sing them and 11 to translate them, and that's not cost-effective.
Music comes with you. You take music over there, you bring songs back here that you've helped to share with people on this side. But you must have also become aware of how much of our music has travelled over there through the years with settlers and people who took their music with them as one of their portable things they were able to take, settling then in the Appalachians and their music becoming embedded in that landscape. Did you encounter any of that yourself?
The movement, yes. It was not long before I realised when people would suddenly come up with a song that I had heard a version of elsewhere. You know, Barbara Allen raises her ugly head very often in many guises. And over the years, I've sort of incorporated, for one reason or another, the fact that a Scottish song will start out in one shape and finish up moving from the mountains in the east to perhaps Texas and be transformed entirely by the time it gets there. Mostly not so much as a ethnomusicological, there's a word for you, not so much as any kind of formal study, but because it's good for a giggle. You can get a laugh out of an audience at the same time as you're imparting some information. And finding versions of, you know, border ballads sung by a Canadian, where, of course, the River Yarrow meant nothing, so it comes out as Eero. Mm-hmm. It's an oral reading, and in that case, of course, it's equally powerful. Some of the oral readings are not that powerful. They're very funny. Mm-hmm. What's the one that I'm most fond of? I guess it's the little tag on, is it Lord Gregory? Wobble she, your bonny wee fet, and wha will glove your hand, and wha will lace your middle jimp wi' a new made London band. And I think I learned that probably from Joe Gordon in the 50s, the man that introduced skiffle and the guitar and all that to this country. I think he sang a version of that. Now, when it hits the States, it's a very appealing little question and answer thing, but when it hits the States, it picked up some wonderful tunes. I have no idea where this melody came from, Fiona. I've forgotten where I heard it. I just thought it was a cracker. And Lord knows at this hour of the day whether you were going to get anything worth recording, but let's see. Oh, who will shoe your foot, my love? And who will glove your hand? And who will kiss your red rosy cheek when I'm in a far off land? Now, if you'd never heard of Lord Gregory, that melody tells you you're still dealing with somebody sad, you know, it's a very serious. And then you get to Texas, you know, and I'm sure it's covering all sorts of places in between, but you get to, who's a gonna shoe your pretty little feet? Who's a gonna glove your hand? And you know, we're off on a different tack entirely, which I find fascinating. And again, it's something that I can use to make people find that Scottish music isn't out there in a tartan haze somewhere and has nothing at all to do with them. In fact, I've been quoted many times as saying all of the best American melodies started out in Scotland. And I find if you deliver a nonsensical statement like that with enough confidence, somebody will believe you.
Jean Redpath, to whom my thanks go out for the warm welcome and the years of song. Here's to many more on The Thistle and Shamrock with me, Fiona Ritchie. Our radio programme comes to you from Scotland. It's a thistleradio.com production. Programme playlists are updated and archived on our website each week. Just check until you see Jean Redpath. And if you missed something on the radio and want to listen again, you'll find that too, all online at thistleradio.com. Connect with us via social media on Twitter at Fiona Ritchie, and our Facebook page is Thistle Radio. If you want to write for a playlist, just send a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Thistle and Shamrock, PO Box 518, Matthews, North Carolina 28106. Once again, our guest this week, Jean Redpath, joining Garrison Keillor and the cast of A Prairie Home Companion. See you next week.
Don't know where we go from here. Comes to that, I just don't care. Maybe we'll go to a better place, and the minstrel show will be there. Lay me down, Carolina, lay me down.
The Thistle and Shamrock is a service mark of Fiona Ritchie. Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR Music.